You're tethered.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. I'm Beth Brooke with Ernst & Young. I'm a global vice chair in charge of strategy and regulatory affairs for our firm. And we are delighted to just introduce this panel today, which I think is going to be a fascinating discussion about measuring corporate success. You know, and what is an effective measure of corporate success? I think we all watch quarterly earnings reports and CNBC and see whether or not a company's hit its estimates and prices go up and down. And arguably, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That we all tend to focus on quarterly earnings as a measure of success. Many, though, would argue that that short-term focus is actually dissuading executives from taking a long-term view, making business decisions for the long term, doing the right thing in the interest of stakeholders and the broader society. And do we have a problem with short-termism? And what are the incentives that perhaps are driving that? On the other hand, is there any evidence that there's a lack of strategic decision-making going on and strategic investments being made in the right direction? So it's a legitimate debate to have. And what is success? I bet everybody in this room would define success differently. So how you go about measuring it is very difficult when we all define it somewhat differently. So with that, by way of context, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Stewart. You all know Tom, the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Business Review. He's going to moderate this session, what he would call a, quote, no-bullshit session, I think. And I'll let Tom introduce the panel. So.
Thank you. Actually, that's one of the rules that I'm going to impose and one of the charges I'm going to give to you. But before I do that, we were talking earlier and recognizing the fact that we are, you know, at that time after lunch in the middle of the afternoon on a gorgeous Rocky Mountain afternoon, when as I understand it, our job is to finish before you do. So we're going to try to keep things as lively as possible so that that second wind kicks in at some point during this and we keep it going. We have a terrific panel of people to discuss what I think is a very interesting topic. And the charge I want to lay at you is to keep this a no bullshit zone, because there is an opportunity for any of us sitting here to devolve into sort of standard answers or platitudes about these things. And if you feel we're there, I mean, you know, call us on it. And if we think you're wrong, we'll fight back, because I think it's important to try to get, as Jim Collins was saying in the last session that we were in, a vigorous but fact-based argument. If you read the description of this session that was given to us as a panel, it reads as follows. It said, the bottom line for the American corporation is to create shareholder value. To many executives, this goal means achieving short-term quarterly profits, often at the expense of long-term objectives or strategies for success. Given the complex dynamics of the global marketplace in which American firms compete, is it time to rethink what shareholder value means? Is current share price our best measure of business success, or can we look beyond that metric to longer-term measures? If so, what are they? How do corporations meet the needs of both shareholders and other stakeholders? How will we know if they have succeeded? One of the things that I like to do in my work is I like to look for hidden premises. And there are a bunch of hidden premises in that description. One is that shareholder value is a short-term measure. Is that true? Second is that short-term and long-term are contradictory. That the management for short-term results is inconsistent with management for long-term results, and or vice versa. Everybody knows, of course, that there are trade-offs between them, but are they actually divergent, or is it simply a matter of trading off things? In the real world, I don't know of any corporations that are merely grasshoppers or only ants. The question of whether there are other constituencies than shareholders, I mean, the implication here is that there has never been any other constituency. Well, there have always, of course, been other constituencies. You know, the first large critique of managerial capitalism by Burley and Means said that managers were rewarding themselves at the expense of shareholders, and the other constituencies have included governments, customers. You know, how much do you cut? Your customers would like you to lower your price. How do you trade off that? How do you trade off that against shareholders? So what are these other constituents? The argument about the comment about globalization was interesting. It sort of said, in a global environment, should we be more attentive to stakeholders? And the implication was perhaps that our global competition is more attentive to stakeholders, which might be true of some European companies, but I'm not sure you would say that that is true of Haier or Lenovo or certain or I'm wearing a Wipro T-shirt. I'm not sure that I'm not sure whether they have a take that attitude. And also, there's this hidden premise that business and society's interests diverge. That what is good for the shareholder is bad for society. That's what good for General Motors is bad for America, and that's a premise. So there are all these hidden premises that I hope we can tease out, explore, as we also explore this really interesting question of what measures of success should we be applying to corporations in today's society, in today's economy, for the long-term benefit, I should say, of both those corporations and society. Starting on my far left, is Bob Steele, a senior fellow at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government, a 25-year career man at Goldman Sachs, where he served as head of its equities division, vice chairman. He's now a senior director of the Goldman Sachs Group, a member of the New York Stock Exchange, so that he can actually buy those stocks and buy and sell those stocks, and is the incoming chairman of the board of the Aspen Institute. Next to him is Judy Samuelson, who is the executive director of the Business and Society Program of the Aspen Institute, and worked at the Ford Foundation for 7 years. Is that right? And involved with the social investment fund and various aspects of that. David Greenberg works at Altria. He is the senior vice president and chief compliance officer of Altria, a role in which he reports directly to the audit committee of the board. And to my immediate left, Steve Friedman, senior advisor to Stone Point Capital, a global private equity firm, and also an ex-Goldman person. He retired as a senior partner and chairman of the management committee of Goldman Sachs in 1994, having spent nearly 30 years at the firm, so he spent even more time at Goldman than Bill Meredith. And he's currently chairman of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. So we have a lot of business experience, a lot of policy experience, some academic experience, and an interesting mix of people to bring to this topic. And I'm going to start on the left, and if you would sort of, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to put some meat on the table, and then we'll have a little conversation, and then let you tigers get at it.
Great. Thanks, Tom. It's pretty intimidating, I think, when I look at the audience, and then I also look at Tom, and Steve was my boss for many years, too, so I have lots of ways to disappoint, but I'm going to jump in fearlessly. Let's put a framework here on this. We're talking about public corporations, and if you look at the way the United States economy is, that basically 60 or 70% of the assets or what we produced is produced by companies. About 20-plus percent is produced by the government activities, and about 10% in the not-for-profit world. And about half of that production of the corporate world is publicly held companies. So that puts a size, and this is not the whole economy is being run with this mentality, but this portion of our economy is. And so the question, to kind of speak quite specifically, is market value the best judge? And I think the answer is, to quite specifically, that over the longer period of time, that is the best judge. I can't think of any other better way. That we have a system that measures, quantifies, and I do believe the answer to that question is yes. But I'd like to speak to the two sub rosa issues that you began to tease out. One, is that an ethical dilemma? I actually don't think so. I think I can give you examples where people who are actively bad behaviors are penalized. Industries that I know, for example, if you look in financial services, that firms that did wrong in the mutual fund late trading scandal have been penalized. Their assets are down, the value of their company has been impaired, and they basically have been hurt quite badly by bad behavior. So I don't think that you could get away with acting badly and not pay a price. On the offensive side, you see some companies that are making a culture of ethical responsibility a part of their mantra. And there are lots that you could cite as examples, but I think a friend of Steve's and mine is Sir John Brown at British Petroleum, where someone took a hydrocarbons company and has positioned it as someone who's trying to understand hard issues and deal with them up front and made their logo green. Now, whether you think that's a bit too much or not, that's your opinion, but that's what they're trying to do. And so some people are trying to use an ethical perspective on offense as part of what they're trying to do. So I think that being successful is not discordant with being ethical. And in fact, I actually believe that that'll be a weight in the long term to your benefit. Now, maybe not in the very short term. I was here a few days ago when the chairman of McKesson Corp was talking. And that's a drug wholesaling company. And he was talking about the dilemma that post-Katrina, what could we do? Now, you could wave a magic wand and they could stop their company and pour all of their inventory into New Orleans. Now, that's not responsible for the shareholders. How does the management balance those issues? Because they have an obligation of their shareholders. And his answer was, we tried to do as much as we humanly could while keeping in mind that we wanted to be constructive to this unattractive situation now, but also we couldn't give away the store because we need to have the store here to be open for business tomorrow and for the next day. Second point you raised was really the whole issue of short-termism. And here, I think this is a tricky issue, and it's a bit out of hand in my opinion today. It goes back and forth. I can think over 30-plus years of watching stocks go up and down and mostly up, that basically you go through cyclical phases where people are overly concerned in the short term. And I think today there's a bit of that. And it's been exacerbated by, I would say, misbehavior on both sides. I think that some corporate managements have had imperial chairman CEOs that have taken advantage of the assets in a way that they benefited. And likewise, I think some activists have been playing a little bit close to the wind, too. They're not lots of either, but they're the ones that draw the attention. And so my personal opinion is it's a bit fraught now, but that this will be a cyclical issue. And it doesn't mean you should change our model. It just means that we work through this, and over time we'll be in a better shape. Hopefully that's enough.
I think that's a good. I'd like to underscore that point with a little example that you can put to you. 20 years ago, when Japan was eating our lunch and was on its way to dinner, you had a whole lot of conversation about short-termism in the American economy and a whole lot of suggestions that our capital model should be more like that of Japan or Germany, where you had banks on the board in both Germany and the cartels in Japan, and the cross ownership of shares in Japan, and it created patient capital. That was the term that was being used. That was in the 80s. Then in the 1990s, I remember being in Germany, and people were saying, we've really got to get the banks off the board. We've got to be more like America. I mean, they were looking at the booming American economy, and the Japanese are now very proud of the fact that they're now out of their 14-year recession, and they talk about the unwinding of the cross-ownership of shares. And so these things do have a sort of a cyclical issue. And 3 years ago, the people were at Airbus were saying, our model works an awful lot better, and now now the people at Boeing are saying, our model is working an awful lot better. And I think you're fundamentally saying you want a model where you can get these things engaged.
It's pretty tough to argue if the holy trinity for an economy are stable prices, low unemployment, and good growth. And that's what we should all want. I believe a system with a good underlying discipline of market allocating of resources for a substantial portion of the economy has the highest odds of achieving those things.
Judy.
Well, if he was intimidated, you ought to think about me. I'm about to disagree with the new chairman of the Aspen Institute.
Good.
you said to lay it out there, right? Not exactly disagree, but I think maybe put out some other ideas. I'm going to take a guess that most of you are here not because you think we're doing a great job of measuring business success, but at least because we've got some questions about whether we're doing it in a way that is best utilizing the extraordinary capacity, talent, problem-solving skill, global reach, market distribution systems of what is now the most important institution around the globe, and that is business. So first of all, I just say I think the question that's posed for this panel today is a really important one. I think how we measure business will tell us what kind of metrics business manages itself by. And so the second point, of course, turns us to the management adage that you manage what you measure. And I think that we, in fact, are very much needing some new models of measurement for business in order to really seize the opportunity for business to make the most important contribution it can to tackling some very complex problems. And these problems, I think, are ones that affect not only society, but they go right to the bottom line of business. And I'm talking about everything from the poverty or wealth gap, which is growing, in fact, at a serious rate in the U.S. And around the globe, and as well as things like global warming. I don't care what, maybe I think about these things too much, but put just about any issue out there, and I can bring it back to some of the questions of how we draw the dots back to business and where is the capacity of business to think longer term and bring into its sights the consequences of business decisions, not only on shareholders, but on the communities in which business resides and that host them, the countries that offer the franchise to operate, and of course the environment. So we tend to, in the Business Society program, look at these things as a big, complex, systemic question. And you know, this is the Aspen Ideas Festival, so let's put out some new ideas about how to measure business success. We have a favored consultant that we worked with for many years named Adam Kahane, and he always said that the system is perfectly designed for the outcomes that we actually see. And I think that the intense focus on share price, which is often what people really mean when they see shareholder value, and if it's being monitored on a daily or even hourly basis, as we sometimes are doing today, but the short-term focus of markets and business, I think, in fact, is making it very hard to take a more robust view of business success. So we have a model that we've been using for about 10 years as we've worked initially primarily in business schools to say, first of all, what are business schools teaching and helping managers take on the leadership roles that we think managers are going to need to take in increasing increasing level of importance as global leaders. And this model we call social impact management, and we think it's really built on questions more than answers at this point. And I think a lot of it is about asking the right questions before you can figure out what it is that you measure. And we have three levels of questions that we suggest need to be asked. And the first one is, what in fact is the role and purpose of business or a business activity? And this, of course, at least gives business managers and emerging students of business pause. At least they can't quickly say the purpose of the business is to enhance shareholder value and quote at least that part of Milton Friedman that talked about that. So at least we say, at least it's an open question. And I think if you actually watch how businesses do manage and how boards wrestle with many of the competing objectives of business, in fact, it is more complex. I don't believe that businesses manage only the share price. I think, in fact, they have many, many conflicting sometimes, but ways in which they have to think carefully about competing objectives and what is the optimal way forward. And so the first question, what's the role and purpose of business? The second one we think you need to kind of think about is, what's the context in which business operates? And that goes right to the questions of stakeholders and who else gets to weigh in. It's all about corporate governance and raises all kinds of other questions that are being raised today. This is not getting to the Enron and questions of right and wrong that I think were addressed by Sarbanes-Oxley. This is really entering into a question where a lot of decisions are really gray. It's not about this is ethically right or ethically wrong. It's about a world in which the current short-term measures of success are really externalizing the cost of business onto people that don't have a seat at the table. And so that's at least an open question about what's the context and what are the other things that need to be considered and who else gets to decide about how to measure business success. And then the third order question, of course, is really the metrics and how do you measure business success. And so that's the third question that we suggest to business faculty that they need to be raising in the context of teaching management today. And as Beth, very capably put forward at the beginning, a lot of that is about time frame. Shareholder value in the short term, I don't think anybody up here is going to say that that's going to necessarily always lead to the best decision making. And so the best firms like BP, and that's a natural for the oil industry that has a very long-term time horizon, the best metrics come when you're looking at decisions and consequences over a long-term period of time. So we're all about saying that this is a great moment to be asking about some new questions about metrics and measurement.
Judy, if you look at the petroleum industry and look over a long period of time, and I have 15, 20 years might be a pretty good long period of time, unfortunately the best performer is ExxonMobil.
Best performer by what measure?
By market value. So I mean, you had said shareholder value over a long period of time seems to be okay if your time frame is all right. But if you give a fairly long time frame here, your best performer is not going to be BP, but is going to be one that seems to be that one that many people would argue, and I would be among them, is contributing to the tragedy of the commons. I mean, is not playing the socially responsible role that a BP would. How much time frame do you need for that
to kick
in?
Well, I think it depends on the context and the kind of decision you're taking. I mean, I want to go back to the Japan example. I've been in a lot of rooms recently where people keep on talking about the rise and fall of Japan, and who came up with the Prius? This is a society or a culture in business that was willing to make an investment and stay with that investment over a very difficult decade of trying to figure out whether or not this would pay out. And they were looking real long term and said, this is a model that may not prove in the short term, but over long term, if we can get it right, we're looking at metrics that will help us position a product that, in fact, has turned out to be an incredibly important investment for the climate of where we are now. So, I think it depends again on industry and time frame. But the short-term focus of business today, I think, on average, is almost anyone would agree that it's become increasingly short. The average share of stock was held, I think, 10 years ago.
The focus of the stock market buyer is not the focus of the management committee, as you were just saying. You ought to separate the market from the market from the management.
But those pressures, of course, do. It is
yes.
a system.
Yeah, exactly. David.
I was absolutely floored when I got into a corporation 18 years ago with the focus on share price. That was back before Blackberries and even before everyone was wired and had computers. But a piece of paper came around about four times a day talking about what the stock price was. And
Was this at Philip Morris?
This was at Altria, the predecessor, Philip Morris Companies. And there was a time when, not too long ago, 15 years ago, Fortune called Philip Morris Companies the second most admired company in America. And looking at the perspective from today, that's a pretty remarkable thing. I think Altria is doing better than we were doing a few years ago in that respect. But still, I wouldn't put us at the top. And I think that Altria is an example of what can happen, how much the lag time is between long-term value and short-term share price. There was a time around that same time when people on Wall Street were saying Philip Morris Companies was going to replace IBM as kind of the new leader in the Dow. And again, to look at that from the perspective of today seems like, distant or impossible history. So I think that those of us in management at that time who were trying to think about the long haul felt that one of the biggest hurdles we had was our short-term success. And I think that share price, because it's so clear and so empirical, and business is so much better at focusing on things that can be measured and can be tracked and can be moved, we were at a loss, and they're still a little bit at a loss, at what else to look at. What are the non-financial and other measures to look at? Businesses can manage for the long haul, and I have a couple of examples within our own company. Less than 10 years ago, we took a decision that we knew would tank the stock. We knew it would cut the stock virtually in half, but we thought it was the right thing for the long haul. It involved cutting the price of our most important brand by about a third because premium pricing had gotten out of hand and we just whacked it from one day to the next, and Wall Street, cut our share price by about 40%. We were fully capable of that because we thought for the long haul that was the right thing for the franchise and for the corporation. But in many, many other areas where it seems almost as clear that you've got to do something for the long haul, you're a bit at sea about what to do. And so I think the story of Altria was a story of how share price can really mask what's going on. And I see that in the larger corporate sector. I think there is such a yawning gap between the expectations that our societies have for us and the actual perceptions that normal people have. If you ask normal people about what goes on in major corporations, they would say that the senior executives make outlandish amounts of money, spend most of their time flying around on corporate jets, figuring out how to move jobs out of the country. If they are profitable, they're trying to figure out how to improve technology to cut more jobs. If they're not careful, if you're not careful, they'll take away your pension benefits while they'll feather their own nest. At the same time, they're expecting us to solve problems like global warming and global health. And I think that each corporation has a huge task in terms of figuring out what are the things that matter to the key stakeholders they have. I don't think there's going to be any answer. I think Judy's right that it's a series of questions. And I think that in general, the one other measure that companies have to think about is sort of their reputation and the brand value of their corporation as opposed to the things they sell, and how that will impact everything from their employees to other stakeholders. Because I think in the end, these days, we don't have a hell of a lot more than our people. Some companies have built-in advantages with technology and resources and other sort of things that are historical. But I think for the long, long haul, about all you have is your people and some sort of trust. And you've got to get a handle on what moves that and what levers to pull for that. And I think over the long haul, share price will reflect that. But decisions aren't made over the long haul. Decisions are made today and tomorrow and the next day.
Plans are made over the long haul, and decisions get made today, which is an interesting question. I think you put two interesting ideas on the table. One is reputation as another proxy, and brand equity is a proxy for reputation, as a proxy for a sort of a quantifiable but non-financial measure of performance, which is an interesting new idea, or new to this discussion. And you've also, when most people talk about short-termism, they talk about fear, short-termism as being a fear. Mr. Lauder was saying earlier that I can't give money to the arts because my share price will be punished. But the flip side of that is the giddiness of success in the short term, blinding you to what may be, to the fact that there may be, having a great party, but you don't realize there are termites in the woodwork. So the giddiness of short-term success, I think, is an interesting new piece to put into the conversation about short-term versus long-term. Steve?
Thank you. I'm just so flattered that you have two investment bankers here to talk about business statesmanship. I can remember the time when we ranked just behind used car salespeople and just ahead of the Ku Klux Klan.
We were probably below you. But
Yeah.
We don't have any Congress.
At that time you were ahead of us.
Bob and I grew up in a partnership, and the senior partner for many years, who was a giant in the business, and he was not a very politically correct person. He had a very heavy New Orleans accent, a little bit of a lisp, and he used to say, "We're greedy, but we're long-term greedy, not short-term greedy." And we all grew up in that tradition that, yes, you wanted to make money, but you wanted to do it over the course of a long career. And one of the other axioms that kicked around the place a lot was that it takes a long time to build up a reputation. Pat Patterson grew up in that place, too. It took a long time to build up a reputation, but it could you could lose it very, very quickly. If I were running a public company today, I think it's outlandish to send around something with a stock price four times a day. I think it's absolutely bizarre. It's exactly what I wouldn't want people thinking about. When I would talk to analysts, or if I went on road shows, I'd be telling them if you really want quarterly earnings with metronomic regularity, you may find some company that can produce it, but it ain't us.
They'll probably be going to jail soon after.
Well, the people who produce it with regularity, somewhere, the odds are at some point they have a cookie jar, and that's not that doesn't pass the sanitary and dietary laws today. And I tell them over a long term, though, we think we're going to make a really good risk-adjusted return for you. I think that it is crucial, in my view, for a well-run business to make money and make healthy amounts of money, or else it's by definition may not survive. It certainly won't be a leader. I think it has to be perceived as doing it in a in an exemplary way. I think that's, and I'm going to use a phrase here, and I'm going to come back to it, enlightened self-interest. I'm talking about this not as a do-gooder. I'm talking about this as the enlightened self-interest of a capitalist. I think for two reasons it's crucial that you be perceived as an exemplary corporate citizen. One, we're in a tremendous competition to get the best people. And your best people, they don't go to most businesses unless they want to make money. But they want something more. They want to have a sense that they're going to a place that they can be proud when they tell their friends they work there. Secondly, your clients, and all of you in this room are clients or customers, really would rather do business with people that they respect. So now I would suggest that when you think about this issue, play a mind game. Put yourself not in the position of people at the Aspen Institute thinking about this abstraction. Think of it as if everyone in this room, as if you were shareholders in a corporation. You had a large amount of your retirement savings invested in the stock of the corporation. Secondly, you had your kids' education, your grandkids' education invested in a trust in this corporation. And thirdly, you're a trustee for the local hospital, and a lot of the assets of that trust, of that endowment, are in the stock of this corporation, and then decide just how much of reducing global warming and so on that you want the corporation to do as opposed to minding its business. I'm going to make the argument that as part of being a good corporate citizen, a corporation should do what is in its enlightened self-interest in terms of advancing the economic interests of the corporation. And that does include things like training and treating your workers well. I think you would like very much to have Fortune magazine say you're one of the 50 best places in the country for people to work. You ought to be supporting the local hospital. Your best people very often want to have a chance to do pro bono publico work, and you're going to keep and retain and recruit better people if you let them do it. But I'm going to argue that when you start talking about major societal ills that are not germane to the ultimate goal, which is maximizing shareholder wealth over the long term, that is something that you ought to have a great career, and then follow the giants. Follow Warren Buffett, follow Bill Gates, devote yourself to that. Give your money to it. Rather than have me, as the hypothetical manager of your corporation, decide I'm going to give X million dollars to this. I was talking to a friend today who had been coerced into going to a benefit for some kind of an animal defense fund thing. Well, it's a good cause. He just doesn't happen to be interested in animal defense. Why would you want me, as the chairman of the company, deciding that that is one of the major things that the country ought to be focusing on? Why don't you just want me to generate substantial profits, take your share of the dividends, or take some of your share of the capital gains, and devote it to the causes that you think are good? Now, I'd like to quote, in response to Judith's comments, the founding father of modern economics, Adam Smith, who said, and I'll have to paraphrase him because I don't have the quote down right, but he said he's never known anyone who purported to be trading in the public good to do much benefit for that. And he then went on to say you don't get your dinner for the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, or the brewer. You get it for their regard to their self-interest. I think that right now, the United States is got the most formidable economy in the world. As the chairman pointed out, it was not all that long ago that we were considered a hollowed-out economy and that we were perceived to be on a downward slide. We have no room for complacency. The giant sucking sound that I hear isn't jobs going to Mexico and all the baloney that you heard with NAFTA. It's just the pull of populist politics, the risk of overregulation, the risk of too much of a lawsuit culture. I think the managers of our businesses today have an enormous amount to do to keep the golden goose producing, keep the entrepreneurial spirit, to keep creativity, to keep technology, to keep up with the laws and the compliance. In chess, there's a concept of the overworked piece. If you ask a piece to defend too many things, it becomes very vulnerable and you wind up losing. It may well be that the people who are running General Motors and Ford, the people running U.S. Steel and Bethlehem Steel, people who are running United Airlines and U.S. Airlines, and even the people who are running IBM years ago were doing wonderful things for their community, but they ran their corporations into the ground. I would love to have American business be at the top of the league tables in terms of creativity, technological development, just creating wealth in this society, which will lift a lot of boats, and have that wealth be the pool from which, whether through government or through philanthropy, private philanthropy, we start addressing some of these needs and not distract them away from their comparative advantage.
I want to now provoke a fight between you and your ex-boss.
Well,
not a fight, a conversation. Because one of the things that Steve, that you said was that you wanted corporations to, you talk about thinking about global warming as opposed to minding its own business. Now, Goldman has actually just taken some pretty serious positions about global warming. And can you, I mean, I know it's been mostly Paulson's doing, I think, that was with these papers and things that,
yeah,
that Goldman was doing. And can you talk about how those are not as opposed to minding Goldman's?
Yeah, I don't think you'll be successful, to be honest. We have too many years of shared Kool-Aid that we've drunk to basically evoke too much discourse. But I think the reality is that there's some pretty complex issues of what economists call public harm, where there's not a price applied, so a market mechanism doesn't work. The easy example is the penalty inflicted on society by excess hydrocarbons. Economists describe that as an impairment that's been developed with no value assigned. So no one paid a price for
it. No one pays
that.
For it. Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that it's quite complex econometrics that has been organized. I think there's some of these issues relating to pollution. And in our country, we've now got pretty strict rules. I don't come from a manufacturing company, so I'm not an expert on this. But it's pretty clear as to what you can and can't do. I think that in general, as I said before in my first comments, I think some companies have decided to make a mantra of good citizenship a part of their brand. And I think it's a very logical and appropriate ambition for some companies. And I'd rather not discuss Goldman Sachs in particular because I think it's just one company. But I think if the management of Goldman Sachs, which neither Steve nor I are today, views doing things like that as part of its brand, then I think it's a good thing. You know, I will now evoke Goldman Sachs. I'll violate. There are 25,000 employees. We started a program called Community Teamworks. Every year, every single employee at Goldman Sachs is encouraged to give one day a year to community service around the world. 25,000 days delivered into their communities. Goldman Sachs has basically an air traffic control center that sends these people to Habitat for Humanity, sends them to clean a park, sends them to work in an orphanage or whatever. Now, those are things that are good for our brand and also, as Steve said, make our people like working at Goldman Sachs. And so I think those are the kinds of things. And I don't think it's a matter of doing... I gave the McKesson example where I think that you just can't do as much as you might wish.
Trudy, I know that you and I talked earlier about you mentioned earlier that the idea that you should make a lot of money and then give it away like Warren Buffett was exactly what you thought was a symptom of a problem. that Steve has proposed as an example of right behavior?
Funny position of being both incredibly dependent on philanthropy. I have a $2 million budget that I have to raise every year, and I do that through the largesse of corporations and private philanthropists. But I also can sit in the look at this other perspective. I also worked at the Ford Foundation for 10 years and loved it. But I was also in business and other places, and this is culturally specific. The U.S. model has been to define corporate citizenship, which is the language that Bob used, and volunteerism, which is partly what philanthropy, which has come up in Steve's comments, as being business is over here, and then when you have extra time and extra money, then you come over here and you decide whether or not to support the animal shelter or the hospital. That is not what we're talking about. And you have to get outside, unfortunately, out of the U.S. framework, which is very hard to do because it is ubiquitous in this space, and realize that philanthropy is something that's tax advantaged in the United States. We have a tremendous culture of it. Philanthropists have done everything from build our libraries to our schools and created a great, wonderful legacy in very many ways, including institutes like this one, and have contributed tremendously to the building of social society in the United States. But we're not talking about volunteerism, and we're not talking about philanthropy. We're talking about what does a business make, what products does it create, and what are the costs of that product, and to what extent are they being externalized on people that don't get to actually weigh in on the decision making? What are the ways in which the product is secured, and what are the impacts of that on the populations? What are the questions that are raised by employees? What are the goods and services that are delivering? What are the long-term questions that the business faces day to day to day? That's what needs to be examined, not philanthropy, not volunteerism, as wonderful as volunteerism has been. And I do believe that there is an enlightened self-interest question around volunteerism. There is research that suggests that companies that encourage volunteerism have happy employees. But we also know that employees today are looking at a business from the vantage point of what is fundamental to this business, what business are they in, and how is the product that they're creating, what are the impacts of that, what are some of the consequences and even unintended consequences that are not measured in profits in terms of, you know, the black and white of profits and the easy to measure financial results. You know, take it up to the kind of sphere of countries. I mean, we talk about the health of the economy and we measure it by things like the growth in the GDP. Well, the GDP adds, but it doesn't subtract. It's like you don't put the value on things that are negative. So the Exxon Valdez incident, everybody always says in this business, was great for the GDP. You created a lot of equipment, you flew a lot of people around the globe, there were a lot of newspapers sold, there was a lot of employment created locally for a period of time.
Good GDP and bad GDP. Sure.
However, you know, was it really, in fact, something that increased our well-being? Does a GDP capture our well-being as a society? And I think it's the same question of the measure of business. I would not measure the business by the philanthropy. In fact, I tend to think that philanthropy has allowed American business people to put a box around the real deal in terms of what we need to measure in terms of business success.
Can we get an example or two of
what Judith is talking about? I can tell you that there is very low constituency in business for oil spills. So I'm not clear as to just what products it is or what business decisions you're talking about.
Well, I think that, you know, we were talking about BP and Exxon earlier. I mean, it is interesting that it was the European oil companies that were the first ones to drop out of the Global Climate Change Coalition in Washington. We essentially start to say we need to look at questions of global warming. I mean, that's not something that comes up as easily in the American, you know, capitalistic system of measurement. It's easier to kind of externalize those costs and think longer term. And the question of your example, I think, earlier, where you talked about someone who is an employee but also a pensioner and also uses a local hospital, et cetera. Well, there is an idea today of kind of looking at things as universal investing, and that someone who's in a pension fund or a large public pension that has to stay invested in the larger economy is starting to say, you know, we may be doing well over in this side of our portfolio, I mean, by externalizing costs from this industry, but what's it costing over here in another part of our portfolio? So if in fact, you know, global warming is real, I'm one who happens to believe it is, and I happen to believe that, you know, human decision making is a big component of it, you know, then you have to look at what's it doing on the insurance, you know, the reinsurance industry, and what are the costs that are being pushed out in terms of cleanup and the costs of some of these extreme weather patterns that may be related to global warming. So, you know.
Well, I think David, yeah. I wanted to hear you on this for two reasons. Number one, Altria has always been one of the most philanthropic of all corporations. And number two, you've also been one of the most vilified of all corporations for the products that you made. You've seen the management of the company have to learn to listen to some of those outside voices in ways that they probably weren't when they were sending around the stock price four times a day.
Yeah. Of course, now you can get the stock price
right now. They're looking at it.
Times a
now
day
they're looking at 1,000 times a day on their Blackberries, right? But it's another
question. I mean, I think that Steve is right in lots of ways, but I think that the bigger question, and I think he'd probably agree, is that, yeah, I think companies are best at sticking to their knitting, but it's a question these days of what's the knitting? What's the long-term knitting? And I think that it's not. I disagree with Judy, because I think that she's asking companies to go beyond a self-interested model. And I'm not sure that an institution like a corporation is all that good at doing that. I think individuals can be good at doing that. I think it's better to look at it from the point of view of what is the long-term impact on your business of what you're doing? What are the expectations of society vis-a-vis that? What are the consequences if you don't deal with some of those problems? What other institutions are going to deal with those problems? Who has the expertise to deal with those problems? And sort of at the end of the day, what is the smartest role for you long-term? I would argue for Altria and for Philip Morris, long haul, it is smart for Kraft Foods to get on top of childhood obesity and other kinds of obesity. And that if Kraft leaves that to other institutions of society, it is not as likely to be good for Kraft, or I would argue for the society, because Kraft has enormous resources and enormous ability to talk to and reach and affect millions of consumers every day. On the Philip Morris side, I think that society expects a responsible tobacco company to leave no stone unturned to make the product safer or as safe as possible. And long haul, a company that can do that has enormous self-interest at stake there. I think to transfer to the oil industry, you know, for ExxonMobil and Chevron and others to leave it to government and other institutions to solve this problem is asking for most of their toes to be shot off. Because if they don't participate in the solution, the odds that the solution will have the technical sophistication and kind of real-world view is very low. So I think that we're in a period where the long-term self-interest of the corporation is being redefined day in and day out, and that the genius of management, if we can ever get there, is to figure out what that is and what those levers
are.
It's a lot more complicated than either our short-term share price or lots of the other things we look
at. One of the questions we're asking, I mean, is what's the unit of analysis?
Yeah.
And if you use an ecological metaphor, and it's a metaphor and not necessarily a reality, but if business exists, if business exists as one set of species, one kind of species in an ocean that includes many other kinds of species, and if you are a shark in that ocean, what is your responsibility for the ocean?
I like to think of us as a guppy, but...
Well, if one is a guppy, you know, what is the best thing? Does the guppy have a responsibility for the ocean other than being the best possible guppy it can be? Should a shark, you know, but then one of the questions I think that we have is what happens if the ocean, what happens to species?
You can't avoid the political process. I mean, you can't really expect
you can have a very enlightened corporation, but you can't really expect them to put themselves in a competitive situation which is dramatically different than their competitors. If in a world where a lot of smart people have a lot of different ways to approach a problem, you can't really ask one auto company to self-impose on itself a totally different cost structure, to build in different fuel economy standards without it. So I think you have to ask government to, yes, bringing them in for the technological skills and so on. That's where the ultimate standards of how to take care of the ocean have to be.
Well, that makes sense on the cost side. Of course, on the opportunity side, you do want to differentiate. So that while it would be unfair, it might be unfair to for it might be unreasonable to ask a company to assume to ask one auto company to assume a disproportionate burden of costs. It's certainly what management tries to do, to get a disproportionate sense of opportunity with something like the Prius, for example, or going after SUVs.
You're going to have to bring this down from 90,000 feet to real issues to deal with.
Let me give an example.
Well, let
right
me just
now.
Finish this point, because if you have a corporation that looks on it and says, this is a great branding opportunity for us to do it, then they have a self-interested reason to do it. If they look on the Prius as a great opportunity, they have a reason to do it. If you're asking them to take on costs that they look upon as being for the entire common weal, then I think you have to make that an industry-wide standard.
I don't think anybody's...
I think it's really important to be very situation and context specific, because I think it's all about self-interest. I mean, I'm total agreement with David on this. I think it's all about self-interest, but it depends on what industry we're talking about, what problem we're talking about. Different industries will have different kinds of definitions of self-interest. An example right now is that the mining industry... The 12 large mining companies that make up something like 80% of the production around the globe have banded together to essentially say we need to figure out these questions about what's called the resource curse. This at least belief that the more you're endowed as a country with rich mineral resources, the more impoverished you're likely to be. Now they are delving into understanding what are the best practices in countries and in regions and in local economies and business practices acting in that actually have tried to manage the resources with government and nonprofits and business at the table in a way that tries to think about what's the long-term benefits and how do they get best distributed. And the reason is total self-interest. They're not getting ahead of, they're not adding costs from where they're sitting. If they don't figure this out, they will lose their franchise to operate.
No, they'll be nationalized.
They're a long-term player. Yeah, they're like oil. They think long-term. We have so many wonderful examples of this coming out of business now. The sense that somehow business is way past shareholder primacy. I mean, global businesses with global brands, with the need to attract talent that wants to be at that business, the franchise to operate, the yin and yang of trying to figure out how to create a workforce that's going to work for them and how to work with business and the education systems. These are questions that business is working with every day around the globe. And our global brands are the ones that are leading this. They're way past this question of it's all about share price. I
mean, although it's normally in response.
I want to ask Mike to come in, then I want to get to you guys in a second. First Mike, and then we'll
Bob,
come out to you.
Bob, okay. But I think you made my case. I think it's all about shareholder primacy. But in the end,
Bob,
in the end, that that people, Nike can't afford to have their brand impaired by poor manufacturing standards. They just can't have it. That impairs their brand. And they might not have realized it. Last year we had a panel here with four people, including Gap, Disney, Hasbro, and one other person that I can't remember, talking about how challenging it is to manufacture in these places. They figured out that part of their brand at a wonderful company like Nike or Gap is to be seen as an enlightened person. It's completely about the idea of longer term maximizing the value over a long period of time of the assets they were entrusted with by their shareholders when they chose to be the management of a joint stock company born several hundred years ago. And I think that's really what it's about. Warren Buffett said it best, in the short run a voting machine, in a long run a weighing machine. And it turns out in the end to be that case. So I think that you're right. You just don't realize it, that basically it really is about, in the end, long-term enlightened self-interest of the people who've entrusted you with their capital to manage on their behalf.
I want to ask, or open this up to questions, and I want them to, please, please, if you can, make them brief and end with a question mark. Sir.
Yeah.
And can you identify yourself?
I've run five corporations that have all been in trouble. And they all get into trouble for one reason. They fail to keep sight of what their customers want. If you fail to understand, and your customers are be Nike, who their customers don't want to buy it because it's being made someplace else, they got to make that adjustment. But if they're not focused on the long run, on share value, they're not going to be investing in that company. I don't care what they're going to have the best strategy for the community, but if that isn't part of what their customers value them, they're not going to be successful. Now, I believe you do have, to your point, you have number one importance is your customer. Number two is your employee. Number three is your shareholder. Number four is your community. And they're all part of it. But if you forget the customer, you don't have to worry about the next three.
This is a good, let me take this and try to turn this into a question, because we actually, this is the first time the word customer was used in this conversation. And the customer is sort of an ultimate or maybe the first arbiter of the creation of the of these other circumstances. And I don't know if anybody would like to sort of pick up that and put that onto the table here.
No, I tried to make the point earlier that part of your brand, part of people wanting to come work for you is feeling proud of the brand they're going to be working for, and part of people, customers wanting to do business with you is that they feel good about you. I was on the board for many years of Walmart, which for a long time thought that they had a sense of mission. Their sense of mission was, we want to get the best possible goods at the lowest possible price, give them to people in the most attractive possible surroundings, and we're going to make the paycheck of the people in the bottom several quartiles of the country stretch a lot further, and that makes us feel good. They've come to the realization, as Alan said, that there is a larger brand identification out there that they better start getting cognizant of. But at the end of the day, you can do everything Judith is saying without, and Bob made this point, without departing a minute from, this is what we have to do to preserve the long-term value of the franchise. And by the way, it really, you get the best, as I say again, you get the best people working for you if you do that.
That's an interesting aspect, by the way, of Walmart, is that as they hit this stone wall about realizing that there were weaknesses in this model, that the things that have started to create the pressure on Walmart, same time their stock plateaued. And basically Walmart's stock has been flat for about 8 years. And so that they were reaching some limitations to the model as they had conceived it. And so one of the manifestations might have been in the market, and the other was the manifestations in the community resistance that they were getting. So there might have been more synergy there than people realized. We have a question here, the gentleman with the red shirt, and then we'll go to the back and then in front.
My name's Larry Gelman, and I've been working as a money manager for 26 years, investing in predominantly American companies. And I wanted to shift the focus of my question a little bit, because the topic is the definition of success in corporations. And I'm thinking in terms of how the people who run the companies define success. I think we're in an environment now where, I'll say this and I don't know if it's true, but a higher percentage than ever before of a CEO or top management's compensation come from stock options and other non-cash forms of compensation. And now we have issues coming up where it seems clear that the temptation to backdate options and to do things that are unethical and illegal was too much for a lot of people to resist. And I guess my question is, the people who are involved with seeing these things on a large scale see a shift over the last 5 to 10 years in terms of how does success is defined in terms of the people who are actually running the company, and particularly in terms of the impact that how they are compensated and the changes in the way they're compensated have had on the ethical underpinnings and the way success. I mean, doesn't that in and of itself breed a short-term orientation if your own compensation is so directly linked to the short-term performance of the stock?
Would either of you like to? It might be. Bob, why don't you take that, and then I'd love to see if you could respond to this from the standpoint of somebody who's now looking, doing it private equity stuff, where you don't have a market, but you have enormous get-rich opportunities.
Yeah, I think you're on to a really good point, to be honest. And you know, the late part of the last decade of the last century had a lot of wonderful things in it. You know, great technology was created, new companies were started, a lot of wonderful things. And I don't know who's someone's pacemaker or something. The I think that excessive focus on compensation and stock market price crept in, and so I think this is a lingering issue. There's a lot of debate among compensation consultants as to what's the right way to pay a CEO of a Fortune 50 company. There's a lot of debate, and I think the pendulum moved towards more stock-based compensation, and it was thought that that aligned management with shareholders. Now, the good news is it's generally not short-term oriented. These people spend decades there. If you look at the executives of the Fortune 50 companies, these are not guys bouncing around for the next best pay package like an NBA guy. These are people that spend their careers there, and they've worked their way up. It seems to me that maybe the pendulum has swung a bit too much to the stock-based compensation, but it's not off by miles, but it seems to me that would be my hunch. Listen, what I'm learning about option backdating and things like that is abhorrent. It's embarrassing to anybody who's part of business that people are getting to bet on races once they're over or at the first turn. It's not right. And to the extent that that wasn't communicated to compensation committees and it was a rigged game, it's embarrassing. It should be pursued to the maximum extent by law, is my opinion. And so that would be my reaction 100%. But the whole idea of executive comp, I think this grew out of the 90s, and especially with smaller companies, and then spread to bigger companies. And consultants thought it was right to have it more compensation, more stock market-based. And my hunch is this moved a bit too far, would be my reaction. And you're right about the things going on that seem like shenanigans. It's terrible.
It's interesting you think about this, that some of this problem was introduced in the 90s when the problem was of corporate underperformance in the early 1990s when people were looking. And one of the questions is, how could you get greater performance?
Yeah, my stock didn't go up. And how come you made a lot of dough? And they said, okay, fine, pay me in stock.
Right. And so that was the response. And there was also a response about more independent directors and so on and so forth. You get to the end of the 90s and you have a problem of hyper-performance. And so we have some question about compensation, but interestingly, a lot of the other governance issues have been the same. And I think there are some questions about getting governance off onto some different issues. And possibly one of the issues might be looking at sort of non-market measures or ways of taking some of the market pressures off. And I know private equity has grown to, what is it now, 9% of GDP? Is or 9% of U.S. capital is in private equity firms?
It's awful big. I think two of the 10 biggest enterprises in America are very large private equity firms if they pool their entire portfolios.
Exactly. And from your standpoint now, as you look at the things that managers are making decisions with and about, is there a difference of kind in these boardrooms as opposed to the boardrooms, the public company boardrooms that you've seen, or is it just a sort of a difference of degree?
You know, I think there is I'm not sure if it's kind or degree, but I think there is a difference. I happen to abhor the short-termism. I think that I have nothing against stock options. I mean, remember, they were the thing that was going to make sure that interests were aligned. In private equity, you constantly talk about making interests aligned, making sure the manager's interests are aligned with the shareholders. And that's, if it's your own money, in other words, your fund has put X amount into this and you bring on hired hand management, you make sure to give them a sizable stake in the company. You want them to buy some, you don't want them to mortgage the house and kids, but you want them to take enough of their liquid assets so that they have a stake in this enterprise. I believe in a system where when people have options, they keep the shares for the long term. The new Secretary of Treasury was proud of the fact, and I think very rightly so, that he never sold a share of stock. I think if people need to do something for estate planning, I think in private equity, there is, by definition, a longer-term horizon. It's not 10 years. Let's say it's 5-ish years, and they're not worried about quarter to quarter. I'll give you one interesting point. Some years ago, part of the gloom and doom about the U.S. was going to have their lunch and dinner eaten by the Japanese was they were investing so much higher share of their GDP than the United States. we discovered that you can be too long-term oriented. And they were making major, major investments that weren't going to pay off until as far forward as the memory of man. Even with an Asian, we had to take the long view. This was awful long. And the United States was getting a much higher return on those investments. And my own view is we can talk about this conceptually, but it really needs to be up to each board to make a judgment about what's the time frame in which they need to see payoff on investments. I know in our alma mater, we started investing in China back in the early 90s, and we knew that most of us wouldn't really see the payoff on that during our terms at the firm. It was a long-term payoff, but we're real proud of the fact of the way it's turned out.
And an interesting issue here, I know you have a question which I'll get to next, is that that horizon is going to vary from business to business inherently. If you're in a consumer products business,
sure.
Your horizon is inherently going to be less long than if you're in the business of making oil refineries, digging oil wells, making mining or something.
Well, your
like
product
this.
So decisions that, will be less long, but I don't know that your career decisions have to be longer. So a lot of this has to be connected to the turnover of people, which is why if you've recruited the best people and you've kept them and you can keep them there for the course of their career, you will get a lot better thinking out of them than if they're looking at this as a stepping stone to some other corporation.
The question here in the front, we've got a lot of questions, so we'll try to move quickly through them. Yes?
I'm Ellen Gibbs. As somebody who spent many years as an analyst, partly at Goldman Sachs, as a fund manager, listening to endless corporate presentations, the longest term I ever heard is 1 year, 1 year out. It's actually gotten shorter now because of the new rule. What am I missing? What are people saying about long-term strategy, about corporate...
Exactly. You said a no-bullshit zone.
Why have I never heard this as somebody who has been an analyst and a money manager?
I'll give you a quick answer. Because you'd have thrown the people out.
Yeah, you don't want to hear that.
You don't want to hear that. I have sat in a lot of investment committee meetings on this side of the desk, you know, the people from the hospital board or the subject board investing the money, and the other side is a money manager who's either come in as a hero or he's come in afraid that he's going to lose the accounts. And I've never heard someone ask tough questions by the people on the investment committee about what he thought the performance of companies was likely to be 5 years out. He's put on the same foundations that are talking about the some of these good issues for mankind are putting immense pressure on their money managers, who in turn put immense pressures on the corporate managers to deliver returns now. And that's a great locus of this undue pressure.
But there is an issue of who you're talking to. I remember once going into the office of David Kearns when he was the CEO of Xerox. Mm-hmm. And I was at Fortune at that time, and I was going to be interviewing him about some stuff. And as we came into his office, he sat down. He said, "Let me take a breath. I was just talking to a bunch of stock analysts, and I was talking about the next quarter, and I think we're going to be talking about the next 5 years. So let me sort of put my head on differently." He sort of made a gesture of reorienting. I think that may be partly, and I don't think this is a bullshit answer, I think it may be partly who's in the room talking about what. And to Judy's point, that's part of the question of how you're going to deal with all of these clamoring people, because a lot of people want to hear the next quarter and your livelihood depended on it, and a lot of people want to hear the next 5 years and their livelihoods depends on it, and you have to play those off against each other. And in an analyst meeting, you're not going to hear much beyond it.
Where the rubber hits the road is what business managers are actually doing. And the research, the academic research suggests that something like 85% of business managers will forego a net present value positive project that's going to decrease their quarter. So if they're not going to make their number in the quarter, that's what the research says. That's what the research says.
It was research out of Duke. Yes, sir, in the blue shirt here, and then we've got to, want to get as many of you guys in as possible. So we can.
I perhaps shouldn't admit it, but I worked for ExxonMobil for 34 years, retired 2 years ago. And I guess my question is really, you can measure earnings, share price readily. I mean, it's available to anybody all the time. But how do you really get behind the scenes and truly value a corporation? You know, really measure how successful it is. And I'll use two examples. One, because of many of the comments that you've made, where you
comment positively about being taken negatively about Exxon.
I didn't comment negatively about Exxon.
No,
I did. But I said it was the better investment.
And I happen to know quite a bit about both of the companies from an operational standpoint. And if you've been reading the press, you know that BP's had some problems recently. And there's a lot of spin that gets involved. The Enron, you know, it wasn't many years ago.
Absolutely.
It wasn't a long time before they ran into all their problems. It became public that there was a realization, you know, they were being held up on pedestals to kind of management they had and what they were accomplishing, whatever. And we found that the situation, in fact, was quite different. But we didn't know. So how do you really get behind the scenes and really get to the facts and, you know, a fact-based objective evaluation of what corporations are doing? Exxon didn't intentionally cause the values to run into rocks.
I'd like to take that question and turn it to all four panelists.
That was about how it was viewed in terms of the economics.
Let's take that question, which the stock price you can get as many times a day as you want, right? But one measure, I mean, you guys are used to valuation and looking at companies. One thing you look for that is a non-financial measure that says, I like this company. Bob?
I would say, I go back to Alan, who is preeminent in his business. I'd give you four that are non-financial. You could say, what do customers think?
Okay.
You know, if you want more, I can give them. But
employee morale.
Employee turnover, desirability of a place to work. If you're in a technology business, how is it viewed in terms of innovation? All kinds of things like that would be my answer.
Mm-hmm. Nike knew they had a problem because they very carefully test the attitudes of teenagers. That's their edge. And so they found that out real big and clear that they had a real problem because of some of how their actions are being interpreted on the human rights scale. So there's all kinds of markers that companies actually take.
David?
I don't think I could add to the ones that are out there.
See? Overwhelmingly, quality and character of the management team. And, you know, you can look at certain businesses in technology where some of my venture capital friends tell me the most important thing is if they're in the right space and they got there and maybe we'll have to replace the manager. But in the great multitude of businesses in most industries, the correlation with the quality and character of management is intense. And they'll then figure out the things that Alan talked about. They'll know those things. Mm-hmm. It's just the starting point is a second-tier manager who is told the same things isn't going to know how to address it.
So we heard customers, employee turnover and morale, relevant measures of innovation, and a sense of the quality of management team. That sounds like four pretty good things that are, however, not look upable pages. Well, you can't look them up. You can't look up the stock price of the pages of the New York Times anymore. Anyway, but
community or for the public or the media to really be able to measure those kinds of
things. Yeah.
We had a question in the back, ma'am. Yes.
My name is Dorothy Stoneman, and I work for the nonprofit sector all my life. So I have a question about you referred to some of these things need to be managed by law. Mm-hmm. And so given that the corporate world has such influence on law, are there any proposals circulating about how the corporate world's influence on law and on Congress and on control and government politics should be limited? And I put that in the context of the fact that there are limitations on the nonprofit sector, which I've never understood why the nonprofit sector who's working in the common interest should be more limited than the corporate sector who is working in the interest.
It's an interesting question. I had an example of that when there was some stock option stuff, and
we published a
brilliant article by Bob Kaplan and Robert Merton on stock options are an expense and should be an expense. And I wanted to send this article to various congressional committees because I thought it was brilliant and interesting. And my COO said, don't forget to send Bill Solomon's article talking about how great stock options were because you wouldn't want to be seen to be lobbying, recite because there was some stuff before Congress. And so we, sent copies of both of them, and I don't think they were read by anybody. But was there anybody talk about the influence of corporations in setting the playing field, setting the rule, the framework for the rule of law? Anybody want to take that up as a?
My own reaction is I'm just not aware of limitations on not-for-profits. So I'm not saying they're not there. I'm just not aware of it. It's not my I think in the corporate sense, I think the part where it gets invidious, and I think it does, is you have a giant lobbying community that's grown up in Washington, and at some point, someone in power in a corporation taxed them with a certain responsibility. We would like you to, if they're high tech, keep from expensing options, notwithstanding that every accountant in America, every economist says this is, makes perfect sense, or we would like you to maintain that tax privilege for us. And then they go on autopilot. And you may have a big picture out there, but these people on K Street in Washington are focused intently on their particular, and I would say their influence is not remotely helpful.
I agree.
But you know something? That is the, an ill of the political process at large. I suspect it's an ill of democracy that goes back to the Greek city-states. I think we should fix it, but I think you're going to have to fix it by laws, and I think the so-called reform laws that have gone through Congress recently, I don't think are even a Band-Aid on the issue.
There was a great quote from Adam Smith that also said, you know, you never get two business people getting together except to fix prices or in some conspiracy against the public.
Conspire against the public good.
Conspire against the public, and that, of course, happens a lot on K Street in Washington. Yes, sir, in the back, and then we'll get two more quickly, and then we'll have to wrap it up. Okay. Yes.
Notwithstanding the example of Nike or Walmart, is that in the new world of ours, we'll call it the last 10 years of globalization, there are increasing examples of well-qualified PhD types that you can buy, so to speak, corporations can buy that are not in the United States. You can buy iron ore from strip mining that you can't do in the United States. Go get castings in other countries where the rules for pollution are non-existent. Can buy gloves from factories in Pakistan that employ seven-year-old girls with very little safety rules. And every day, U.S.-based companies, private equity or public, face these choices. And the best example I can give you is General Motors, notwithstanding all their problems, 6 years ago told all their U.S. suppliers, match Chinese prices or you're lost. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my question is, where does shareholder value stop in this service?
Anybody want to take that?
I mean, again, I think that that is the reason that good managers get paid a lot and probably always will, because to be successful, you've got to struggle with that in a million different individual situations. In terms of the sort of the rules of the game here versus rules of the game elsewhere, we tend not to focus on the rules of the game we've set up that give us advantages. For example, you know, the agricultural subsidies that we still have or the export benefits that we still have. And if we're going to go to the world and ask other countries to make a sacrifice and make investments, we're going to also have to start at home. And I think that, just to go back to Steve's comments and the political situation, having run lobbying for a Fortune 10 company in my day and also having been a lobbyist for the largest consumer group in America, in an earlier day, I wasn't particularly impressed with the power of either the nonprofit sector or the corporate sector. What's really depressing to me is the quality of debate and the way we engage, not who has the power. And I think that's why we need to make some process changes, because the level of debate and engagement is so low and so unlikely to lead to good answers.
Judy, did you want to?
The irony of the situation you've posed is it's the big bad brands who actually are going to have the best practice, because they're the ones that are in the public eye. They're the ones that the power of the internet has really changed the terms of debate in terms of being able to make or break, you know, how a particular practice is viewed, what's child labor, what's not, et cetera. And beneath that lies a whole host of questions about the performance of business. And again, we looked at those big brands, and ultimately they're the ones that are leading, because they're the ones that are starting to say, we have to drive these questions right down to our supply chain. That's what Walmart is starting to raise, with some extraordinary questions there. I think it comes back to this question of metrics very neatly, because the financially oriented metrics only tell us one piece of the story, an incredibly important piece. To Bob's point, they got to be there. We are, you know, they in fact are the contributors of wealth and jobs, an incredibly important part of all societies around the globe. But if that's the metric we're focused on, and we keep on coming back to shareholder value, and what we really mean by shareholder value is share price, and then it raises questions of what's the time frame and which shareholders are we paying attention to, the ones who are long-term, the traders, or the real owners?
I just think it leads to whispers. I just would do what some enlightened companies have done and basically say, you're supposed to be an analyst. I'll tell you factually what I can tell you. You can come visit, but you figure out what my earnings are going to be next quarter. I don't think most good companies really, who aren't playing with cookie jars, have a high degree of certainty, and I would leave it just the way you implied.
Get rid of it.
Yes.
We are at the end of our time. You can hear that they're applauding us even at a distance.
But applauding us is over.
but what I would like to do is make a couple of quick points in framing. I'll try to draw a couple together a couple of threads. There was a whole thread about, you know, about what's charity and what's not charity, in what's philanthropy and what's strategy. And I think that you can actually think about this, and I'm stealing from some stuff that Michael Porter is working on. If you think about corporate social responsibility in these measures, you can imagine that there are things that are sort of generic, and there are things that are affect a company's value chain, and the things that are strategic. And if you could imagine, for example, supporting a local ballet company, the local utility might do it just out of the goodness of its heart. It would be an act of charity. Capizio's might do it because it's part of its value chain, and American Express might support it because it's a strategic thing to get to that kind of person, that those are the kind of people they want for platinum cards. So in that case, that's not, you know, for American Express to do that is actually not something they're going to tithe themselves for and say we can do 1% or one half of 1%. They're going to say the more of this we can do, the better. And that's the kind of way in which you can do well by doing good and actually get a virtuous circle, and you're doing the things that are relevant to you. So that Anheuser-Busch provokes a little bit of cognitive dissonance when they say don't drink, but they wouldn't provoke cognitive dissonance when they say let's get more clean, fresh water. And you get the kind of cause that actually does affect shareholder value. And that's an interesting framework for this. I think the second thing that we have to realize is that there is this, the issue of companies navigating in a global environment is ever more complex. And I once on a cocktail napkin sort of drew a circle with a company in the middle and then just figured out how many other entities are out there. You know, there's capital markets and there's government, and then there's employees and there's customers and there's competitors, there's suppliers, there's science and technology. And there's a whole lot of little things that orbit around a company, and managing that set of things is actually where you might find a sophisticated set of metrics. How do I weigh these different places, these different islands I have to navigate among? What is the impact of them, and how do I rate my ability and my success on each of these individually and on their interrelationships? It might give you actually kind of a dashboard that would allow you to put yourself in context. And the third thing, I think, is this question about what is the context? I mean, to what extent am I my brother's keeper if I am a corporation, or if I'm an NGO, or if I'm a church, or if I'm a government? What is the extent to which I am responsible for the fate of those around me? And to what extent is my ability to, do, if I want to stick to my knitting, I'm dependent on getting good wool. And to what extent is my, do I have to deal with that? And sort of keeping these things in balance is tricky. And I think that we've come to that realization, come to the sort of tentative conclusion that there is no one-size-fits-all set of measures, but that you do want to get a set of measures that fits you and fits your circumstance, and does take into account those external costs that are relevant, or they're going to come back to bite you later if you don't take them into account. Does take into account the health of the ocean in which you're trying to swim, and does take into account also the importance of the of rewarding the customers who buy your stuff and the investors who put their treasure in your hands to work with. So with that, I think we've been in terrific hands with these four gentlemen, with Bob and Judy and David and Stephen. Thank you all for your great questions.